This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, fresh controversy over the operations of the Gounder Shipping Company in Fiji. Fiji's government accused of creating a climate of fear by refusing to lift the COVID-19 curfew despite no community cases for nearly a year. And World Rugby under pressure to allow automatic qualification for star man Charles Pietau to play for Tonga, his country of heritage. Those stories to come, but first, frontline workers in Papua New Guinea's outer provinces fear they're being left out of the COVID-19 vaccination rollout as the number of cases in regional parts of the country continues to grow. So far, the immunisation programme has been focused on health workers in the capital, Port Moresby. And as Marion Farr reports, it's a situation that has prompted health workers elsewhere to call for urgent action, with doctors going on strike at one major hospital amid fears for their personal safety, while a regional hospital has been forced into lockdown after all but one of its doctors contracted the coronavirus.
While doctors in the Papua New Guinean province of Morobe have been working to contain COVID-19, their own health is increasingly at risk.
We have to make a decision. We just can't put ourselves on the line without being properly equipped to fight against COVID.
Dr. Barry Mutan is a medical officer at Angar Hospital, the region's main health facility. He says it's been understaffed for years, but the recent surge in COVID-19 cases has made matters much worse. More than 60 health workers in the province have caught the virus so far, with the region's total number now above 340.
And now we've got this situation, and they continue to be complacent about this manpower shortage issue that we've had for years.
The concerns prompted about 40 doctors at Angar Hospital to go on strike last week. Dr. Mutan says they want the Provincial Health Authority to hire more medical workers and set up a COVID-19 isolation ward at Angar to protect staff and patients.
So we've been asking for an isolation ward in the hospital so that whoever that we think has COVID, they should automatically be directed to an isolated section in the hospital so we don't get our staff unnecessarily exposed.
The doctors have now gone back to work and the health authority has reportedly promised to address their concerns, although repeated calls by the ABC have gone unanswered. But Dr. Mutan says if that doesn't happen quickly and more workers catch the virus, the hospital risks having to close.
It's about maintaining our critical workforce to deal with other problems in the country in the future. That is the stand we are taking. We want to protect our limited staff.
Do you feel that the majority of resources have been focused on Port Moresby and that the other provinces have been sort of left out?
I sort of feel that. I think that's the kind of feeling I'm getting. I mean, we've had so much talk about big money has been, you know, committed or borrowed for the pandemic, but it does not translate down to, you know, our people here and our frontline health workers.
It's a concern shared by others across regional PNG. East New Britain has a population of more than 300,000 people, but its main hospital has been forced to suspend most services this week after three of its four doctors contracted COVID-19.
They also lost a lot of other staff, including the X-ray, the operating theatre, emergency, even the cough triage where they do the COVID-19 screening. So this has really affected how they can continue to do their jobs in a way that is safe to both the other staff and to the other patients.
Dr. Alex Maha is leading the COVID-19 response in East New Britain. He says vaccinating frontline workers will be key to allowing health services to continue.
For those of us who are actively involved with COVID-19, I think we're all quite unanimous that we want to be vaccinated. And hopefully when the vaccine does arrive, hopefully as soon as possible, those who are still sitting on the fence will hopefully fall on our side and get vaccinated.
Last month, Australia donated 8,000 doses of AstraZeneca to Papua New Guinea. The vaccine is now being offered to frontline workers in the nation's capital, Port Moresby, where the highest number of COVID-19 cases have been recorded to date. But as the virus starts to spread to other parts of PNG, regional areas want to know when they will be in line for the jab. Trevor Magay is the provincial administrator for Oro Province, which recorded its first three cases of COVID-19 on Monday.
At this stage, we have not received any information from the National Department of Health as to what other plans are for the rollout, and we're still waiting for them to inform us so that we can know and inform our workers, frontline workers.
Mr. Magay says getting the vaccine to regional and remote parts of PNG is crucial.
Our workforce in the province, like old, the age group is between 35 and 60. It is really critical for us to get our frontline workers to be vaccinated before we can be able to attend to patients that are coming in.
Trevor Magay, the provincial administrator in Oro, ending that report from Marion Farr with production assistance from Belinda Cora. The Fijian shipping company that's already under investigation over allegations of mistreating its foreign workers is facing a new accusation linked to the incorrect registration of one of its ferries. The Global Union, the International Transport Federation, says Gounder Shipping has registered the Lomar VT Princess 3 as being shorter and lighter than it actually is. As a result, the Federation claims the vessel has been staffed with a smaller and less experienced crew than should be the case, putting the safety of passengers and the crew at risk. Gounder has recently cancelled sailings on two ferry routes, but as Liam Fox reports, as far as the ITS claims are concerned, the shipping company says they are garbage.
Gounder Shipping has been attracting plenty of heat lately. It's currently being investigated by several Fijian agencies after a group of Filipino sailors alleged the company sacked them and left them stranded, homeless and penniless, unable to return home after they raised concerns about their pay and working conditions. Now the group that supported the Filipino sailors, the International Transport Workers Federation, has raised new allegations concerning one of Gounder's ferries, the Lomai Viti Princess 3.
This ferry somehow, on its transit from Canada to Fiji, lost 14 metres.
Sarah Maguire is an inspector with the International Transport Workers Federation, or ITF. What she's alleging is that Gounder, after it bought the ferry from its former owner in Canada and registered it in Fiji, said the vessel's length was 100 metres. Before that, the ferry had been 114 metres long. The ABC has seen a copy of the ferry survey certificate issued by the Maritime Safety Authority of Fiji in January last year that outlines its dimensions. The certificate puts the vessel's length at 100 metres, but information on the ferry obtained from the Lloyd's Register of Ships puts its length at 114.6 metres. And there are other differences. The survey certificate puts the ferry's gross tonnage at 2,580 tonnes, but on the Lloyd's Register it is over 5,000 tonnes, a difference of nearly 2,500 tonnes. So, what's going on? Ms. Maguire claims it's all about cutting costs. The smaller the boat, the less crew, safety gear and maintenance is required.
Say, like, if you have a car licence or a truck licence, you need, the bigger the vehicle you drive, the more experience and the more training you need to have to operate it. And it's no different in the maritime industry. The bigger the vessel you are on, the more experience and the more training you have to undergo to be licensed to operate it.
Gounder Shipping's Managing Director, George Gounder, described the claim that the Lomai Viti Princess 3's dimensions had been deliberately falsified as, quote, full of crap and garbage. He declined to comment further. The ABC has made several attempts to get a comment from the Maritime Safety Authority of Fiji, but there has been no response. Ms. Maguire says the ITF has also tried to raise the issue with Maritime Safety.
They've refused to acknowledge our complaint.
And what do you think of that response?
I think it's atrocious.
Fiji's Ministry of Transport and the Transport Minister, Fayaz Koya, have also been approached for comment.
That report from Liam Fox. The chair of Fiji's NGO Coalition on Human Rights, Nalini Singh, says the government has created a climate of fear by refusing to lift a nighttime curfew brought in over a year ago in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. There have been no cases of community transmission reported in Fiji for nearly 12 months, and Ms. Singh says the imposition of a curfew can no longer be justified. She says in the view of civil society groups and of opposition politicians, the human rights of the Fijian people are being violated.
with community transmission not being present for a significant while, and now that the vaccine is also available, we're saying that the curfew measures must end, as they are an unnecessary burden to the public and severely impede on our right to freedom of movement and association. And there's a plethora of other interlinked reasons why we think that this particular measure needs to go, because we've seen the additional burden that has been put on our formal justice sector. The judiciary is being flooded with perhaps unnecessary workload because of the high number of criminal cases ending up in courts. It's taking precious time and the scarce resources that we have.
What are everyday Fijians telling you about how they feel about the curfew? What's happening on the ground in terms of people's perceptions on how the curfew is going?
For us in the coalition, what we are seeing is that there is a general call to see an end to the curfew immediately, as it is unnecessary. We've seen over 4,100 people being arrested for violating curfew restrictions, and that's a really high number.
Another impact of these COVID-19 curfews is the impact it's had on women, especially women in vulnerable positions, potentially being stuck in abusive relationships and having to stay because of curfew. What have women been telling you about their experiences?
Very recently, Shamima Ali from the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre, she has said that COVID-19 restrictions and curfew must be lifted, on the grounds that women who are really vulnerable to violence, they are potentially stuck in with perpetrators. And this is what we saw immediately several months within when COVID-19 came to the shores of Fiji. And we realized that, there's violence occurs at any given moment. And for a woman to be trapped in with potential perpetrator, it is really unacceptable that we have measures in place that would then restrict her mobility from seeking immediate assistance. What we have heard from some women is that, the police are unable to come in to help the women, or if there was an opportunity for the woman to seek help immediately, then knowing that, they are restrictions to movement, is unable to access that. So it is very detrimental for those women who are in such situations. So as the Crisis Centre, which is also a member of the NGO Coalition on Human Rights, we fully support what the Crisis Centre has said in this regard. And, it is detrimental, not just in terms of curtailing of potentially, other criminal activities, but in the case where we know that Fiji is suffering from an extremely high rate of, violence against women and children, this measure does not help.
Nalini Singh, chair of Fiji's NGO Coalition on Human Rights, on the line from Suva, and she was speaking to Marla Damadi. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review. The newly reinstalled coach of Tonga's national men's rugby team, Tota Kefu, is backing a call for star player Charles Piatau to be given automatic eligibility to represent his country of heritage once again. As it stands, the former All Black can only join the Akalitahi's ranks if he first plays for the Tongan Sevens team at the Olympic qualifying tournament in Monaco later this year. But Piatau looks certain to miss that event because of club commitments in England. The chief executive of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, Dan Leo, is calling for a common-sense solution to the eligibility problem, which has blighted Pacific Islands rugby for years.
Piatau, bang, through he goes, and watch this offload on the inside.
That is sublime skill from this young man, Charles Piatau.
In 17 games for the New Zealand All Blacks, Charles Beattau made quite an impact, but he's been out of the picture since 2015, and now he wants to represent his country of heritage, Tonga. There are two requirements, a three-year stand-down from the All Blacks, which he's already achieved, and then, for reasons best known to world rugby, he has to turn out for Tonga in the Olympic Sevens qualifier before he can be picked for the Akalitahi 15, with the potential of playing at the 2023 World Cup. But the problem for Beattau is that his English club Bristol will almost certainly be playing finals at the same time as the Olympic event is scheduled to go ahead. Tonga's national coach Tota Kefu says they are still negotiating with Bristol and with Wasps, who have Malachi Fekitoa, another would-be Tongan ex-All Black, in their ranks. But the signs for Beattau in particular are not hopeful.
Him getting away for even a short period of time looks impossible, but we're still trying to have open line of communication with the club. Fekitoa is more likely to play than not to play, but he wants to do the right thing by his club, and we've always let the player have the right to say that because there's lots of money at stake for him and his family. But at this point, we think Malachi is likely more than not, and Charles is very, very slim chance.
So if, as looks highly likely now, Beattau misses out again on his desired Tongan switch, coach Kefu says his chances of ever playing for the Akalitahi in the World Cup would be gone. Former Manu Samoa international Dan Leo says the situation is manifestly unfair, as the fixture clash is not of the players' making. As chief executive of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, he says he will be pressing World Rugby to give Fekitoa and Beattau automatic eligibility for Tonga.
I'll be writing to World Rugby this week. We're in good stead with the new CEO there, Alan Gilpin, who's come in and been really responsive to our requests as Pacific Rugby Players Welfare over the few months that he's been interim. So we're looking at maintaining that relationship and just going directly to him. You know, if there's a clash in the program, they need to look at this. For me, it's the common sense approach. It's, look, he's served, I think it's 6 years now since his last All Blacks cap was in 2015 against Samoa. And, you know, common sense approach needs to be taken into consideration. You know, let the boys play.
No, I totally agree with that. These guys are Tongan, you know. World Rugby always go on about the integrity of the game, but no one questions the integrity when they watch Japan play, when half the team's Tongan, half the team's New Zealanders, and there's a couple of Aussies in there. World Rugby can extract that rule away from the rule books and just make it a plain three-year sit-down, which I think is fair enough, because these guys want to play for Tonga. Are there other agendas in play here? I mean, this seems like a real simple solution to this.
Dan Leo intends to consult the PRPW's legal advisers on the Tongan case, and he's also questioning the scheduling and location of the Olympic qualifier while the pandemic continues.
For me, there's lots of grounds that Tonga could pursue to get this moved. You know, we say it's only one player, but Charles Beattau, you know, he's right at the top of the game. He'd make a massive impact for Tonga coming back, not just in terms of his playing ability, but the experience he's got. And it'll probably inspire, you know, the next generation of Tongans to, you know, to want to play for Tonga too. Charles could be that person. So, you know, for me, they need to go full barrel to get him back, whatever it takes.
But even if World Rugby were to take Dan Leo's common sense approach and waive the need for Beattau and Fekitoa to turn out in the Olympic event, that wouldn't guarantee their selection, certainly for the World Cup qualifiers against Samoa. Dan Leo says it's quite likely those games will be played in New Zealand, with teams selected from the diaspora there and in Australia too now, with a travel bubble about to open. You're a Samoan, of course, but you think that will be manifestly unfair to Tonga?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Based on the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare membership, we're looking at where the majority of Tongan squad is at the moment in comparison to where the, you know, possibly the most of the Samoan squad would come from. And Tonga have got a lot of players in places like Japan, France, Italy, even in England now. A lot more of their playing stocks further abroad than possibly what Samoa have in the MITRE 10 and Super Rugby competition. So just on a very basic outlook, for me, it looks like if I was Tonga, I wouldn't want it to be played in New Zealand. Playing Tonga in New Zealand, very, very different than playing Tonga in Nuku'alofa. Same for Samoa. You know, the All Blacks came to up here in 2015 and struggled. So there is a big difference between having that home advantage and that crowd and just, you know, the whole experience. And for me, that's pivotal to a process and a pathway to making it to the World Cup, that you can actually go to those places and win.
whether we use overseas players, whether we don't, and just use local players in New Zealand. Or there's going to be a corridor now being opened up between Australia and New Zealand. Maybe we can just use Australian and New Zealand players. Look, we just have to adapt and abide and comply by the rules laid down by our governments and then just get on with it.
Dan Leo says a better move would be to play the World Cup qualifiers in Tonga and Samoa.
That'd be a sensible solution. Maybe we can create some sort of bubble between Tonga and Samoa if there's no COVID cases to allow that to happen. I'm sure the governments, being as close to rugby as they are, would be, you know, possibly party to those conversations. So it's thinking outside the box there. But what we don't want is a repeat of what happened earlier with the Women's World Cup, with Tonga playing Samoa in Auckland because of COVID, and there was a 40-0 scoreline, I think it was. Maybe that would have been the case anyway, but you don't want any unanswered questions. You don't want them as players who've worked their butts off to get to these positions just to be massively unfavoured, and you don't want it as fans. It's just about taking our time, maybe stepping back a little bit and say, look, what does the picture look like in 6 months? Once the vaccine's had a bit more of a chance to roll out, once we know the effectiveness, once possibly travel's back up and running, I don't see the rush, to be honest.
And ultimately, Toto Kefu says World Rugby should be doing all they can to ensure that the best players take part in World Cups. If that happened, he says, the Akalitahi could do for Rugby Union what Matamaa Tonga have already done for Rugby League.
We've got some wonderful players and they're all over the globe. So if we can get them on board and get them qualified and get them interested in playing, we stand a very good chance of doing something special at the 2023 World Cup.
Ball's there, Pia Towers first there.
And finally, another piece of Pacific Islands rugby history has been made with a Moana Pacifica women's team taking to the field at a specially arranged sevens tournament in Wellington, where they won their first ever match against a team representing the New Zealand Black Ferns. Former Manosina Samoa World Cup captain Cynthia Ta'ala Timoloa is one of the Pacifica team's co-coaches. She says the growing momentum behind the bid by a Moana Pacifica men's team to play Super Rugby has opened the doors for the women as well.
It's so exciting. We are so thankful to our brothers for paving the way for us. We are here because of what they've done last year. And to have a women's team in less than a year's time is definitely surreal, but we're definitely using the opportunities to our advantage at the moment.
So is it getting overambitious to suggest that this could be the start of a women's Super Rugby team representing the Pacific Islands?
That would be the goal. So I think that would be probably something looking down the lines that could happen. I'm not sure what's happening behind the scenes, but very viable option to have Moana Pacifica as a 15s team in Super.
And the players that are taking part in this tournament, what are they saying about this? I mean, do they kind of get that they could be making a bit of history here for women's rugby in the Pacific? That this could be the start of something very big?
They're now very aware. I think when they first came, when the ladies first came into camp, or first had their first training, it seemed like just another sevens training for another tournament. But as we've delved in and as coaches and management and just reiterating to them the importance of Moana Pacifica, what it means to our ancestors, to our families, to your parents. A lot of our players are not disconnected with culture, but they're not fully immersed in the culture yet. So a lot of them have come because of the culture aspect and want to be closer to it and know more about it. Now they're in camp and we're about to play. They're fully aware that they are the first women to don the Moana Pacifica jersey. It's going to be very emotional for them when they do their jersey presentation, and they're just ready to go. So our players and the management are fully aware of the historical milestone that we're setting already.
And in terms of picking the team and the mix of players, how have you gone about doing that?
It's being mindful of who is sevens fit and who's conditioned at the moment and the time frame, because we've had about a week and a half or 2 weeks to put this team together. And a lot of it is players that we do want, but again, making sure that they're available. A lot of our players work, their mothers or their students. So the availability is probably the key thing that we need to make sure. And then having the players that we do have and just seeing them progress every day, gelling and connecting. You wouldn't think that they've been together for 2 weeks. You would have thought that they've been together for a few campaigns beforehand.
And what's the mix of players? How's that been worked out?
The players and management goes in terms of these Tongans, there's Samoans, there's Fijians, there's Māori, Cook Island and Rotuma.
That's a pretty big mix, isn't it?
It's a great mix, yes. Off the field and how the way they gel on the field. Very close-knit team, very special team.
And this tournament is the start, we hope, of something. Do you have any idea at this stage as to what happens next? When might a Moana Pacifica team take to the field again? Is there a plan?
I don't know. I think our management or the Moana Pacifica management do know. I think that's going to be revealed to us later on in the week.
And as far as the nuts and bolts of the tournament are concerned, how well do you think you might do?
We're never going to be competitive. Competitive and win is the two main things that we're going for this weekend. I know that everyone's dying to play, and I know the Black Ferns and All Blacks are also dying to play our Pacific teams as well. So we're really thankful again to New Zealand Rugby for the opportunity, and it's going to be a massive occasion, but also a really cool one to be a part of. And our team's going to go out, so we're really excited at what they're going to bring.
Cynthia Ta'ara Timoloa, former Manosina Samoa captain and now part of the coaching panel looking after the first ever Moana Pacifica women's team. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart. As always, thank you very much for listening.